Penguin Random House Audio presents Homeland, a memoir of departure and return. This is the author, Rebecca Mead. To George and Raphael. A few years ago, when my son was in middle school, he would every so often ask me an odd question. "What's your favourite apocalypse?" "What do you mean?" I would ask, puzzled and a bit impatient. "The apocalypse isn't a colour, or an ice cream flavour, or a band, or a book. It's not the kind of thing you have a favourite of." "If you had to choose," Raphael, my son, would say. "I know you don't want any apocalypse in real life, obviously. But if you had to pick one, what would it be?" He would offer alternatives. "Would I prefer an apocalypse of fire and explosions, burning forests to the ground and reducing cities to rubble? Or an epidemic, contagion spreading ruthlessly from person to person and nation to nation? Or would I choose his own personal favourite, a zombie apocalypse, hiding out in the woods with a stash of rations, building shelters from sticks, starting campfires with birch bark and twigs, on the run from legions of the living dead who march through the land with their arms outstretched before them, shredded skin hanging from their limbs, eyes rolled back in their skulls?" His own eyes would shine as he described this last permutation of the end of the world, and I would know where his favourite apocalypse was set, at summer camp. For a few years, he attended an all-boys camp in the mountains of Vermont, trading his Brooklyn bedroom for a rustic cabin overlooking a lake. There were lessons in knife skills and fire-starting skills. There was a climbing wall, strenuous hiking, and a fair bit of idling. At least, that was what my husband, George, and I could discern from the very occasional letters our son wrote home. One time, we received a long letter in which he confessed to having accidentally set a patch of hillside on fire when he and a couple of other campers were playing around with a contraband box of matches. What could have been a disaster was turned into a cautionary lesson. The three boys had their fire privileges revoked for the rest of the season. The envelope was covered with penciled postscripts, scrawls of mortification, though later he would turn the story into a comic anecdote. That time when some real-life danger intruded into the highly curated pseudo-risk that the camp specialised in. The camp was intensely rustic, with no electricity in the cabins and no flushing toilets. A cupful of sawdust tossed down the black pit, that'll take care of things. There were bonfires and cookouts and thrilling mass games conducted by flashlight and moonlight. Every session ended with a banquet, for which inventive counsellors decked the dining hall with festooned greenery and papier-mâché sculptures like a stage set, then dressed up in costumes like something from A Midsummer Night's Dream. The camp had been founded on Quaker ethics, which had morphed by the 2010s into an observance of secular, progressive principles. Campers and counsellors stated their pronouns upon arrival. The environment offered an antidote to the popular culture in which boys like my son were daily immersed. Electronics were forbidden, and there were no movie nights or candy Fridays, as there were at some of the camps his friends went to. At the same time, there was also a highly intentional intensification of the contemporary currents of liberal parenting, as they were observed in the part of Brownstone, Brooklyn, in which I lived. Lord of the Butterflies, that was how I thought of the place. I was enchanted by so much about it, and at the same time, it drove me a little crazy. So it was clear where my son imagined his favourite apocalypse transpiring, there, in the sun-warmed freedom and privileged primitivism of a Vermont summer. Meanwhile, he got his apocalyptic ideas, his rich array of alternative end times, from a culture saturated with entertainment that offered the enticements of incipient destruction and violent demise. At the bookstore, he'd be drawn to thick volumes with lurid cover images, a scythe-bearing hooded silhouette, or the close-up quadrant of a young face that was not so different from his own, with brown hair flopping over a green eye, though the skin in the illustration was pallid and grey, and the terrified eye was rimmed with rust-red shadow. When we rode the subway together, he studied the movie posters featuring cataclysmic images plastered on the platform walls. The White House in flames, helicopters circling overhead while a tattered American flag burned, a cityscape of scarred skyscrapers and crumbling bridges. There were images of square-jawed men equipped with exoskeletal body armour and guns so oversized that the combatants would surely stagger under the weight of them, like the kids who haplessly attempted to wield foot-long water pistols in summertime battles at the playground. There were images of good-looking teens advancing warily through dense forest growth, armed with improvised cudgels or lances and dressed in ragged sweatshirts, bearing camouflage print backpacks like the one my son had insisted on buying at an army surplus store and which he was forever filling with supplies for an impending evacuation or escape, a Nerf gun, a compass, a pocket knife, a notebook. The posters were alarming and beguiling. There was a glamour and excitement to the various catastrophes they portended, as palpable to me as it was to my son, even as I would attempt to steer him down the subway platform to a cozier poster from a cartoon or a comedy, while deflecting his persistent questions about what was represented in these action movie images, the firepower of their weapons and the volatility of their civilizations. "We're all going to die," one of Raphael's classmates shrieked excitedly when George and I dropped him off in the playground of his middle school a few blocks from our house the morning after the presidential election. Our son joined the throng of children competitively comparing notes on the night before. Who'd seen the shocking result coming first? Who'd stayed up the longest? Whose parents had cried? While George and I went to walk in circles around the hilly, verdant park at the end of our block, turning over what had transpired as we passed beneath old-growth trees. For months, I'd been in a state of agitation, experiencing an anxious constriction that I knew only from the most grief-stricken moments of my life, during the serious illness of a loved one, or when a difficult work environment had curdled and become intolerable. The edges of my consciousness had turned shadowy. I felt as if my existence had contracted, shrunk down to a meager tunnel of survival. But I'd anticipated that relief was inevitable, and that the shadows would begin to clear. Now, it seemed, the darkness was only at its beginning. "We could leave," George and I started to whisper to each other as we walked through the park in the days and weeks and months that followed. "Should we leave? When will we know whether we should or not? When will it be too late?" We thought of George's paternal grandparents, who fled their home in Vienna with my father-in-law, then 8 years old, and his older brother, only when they learned their names were on a list to be rounded up the next day. We engaged in our own apocalyptic imaginings, watching with despair that was renewed daily as the news unfurled. "This isn't that," we told ourselves. But what this was, we didn't yet know. Periodically, my cell phone now sends me photographic reminders of those days. "You have a new memory," it tells me, as if I have forgotten the march in Washington, with the tip of the Washington Monument wreathed in mist and the hordes milling on the mall. The next day, I slumped in the passenger seat of my friend Nancy's car on the return journey to New York, my son and her daughter listless in the back seat, their cardboard protest signs creased and shoved in the trunk. Nauseated, either from fatigue or fear, even before we set off, I vomited into a Ziploc bag as Nancy drove, then gazed weakly out of the window into the imperceptible distance. Another memory, a rally a few days later, at the Battery in downtown Manhattan, my son's face pinched beneath the hood of a blue winter coat in which he's bundled up, the sky clear and astringent, so cold that before the protest was over, my feet were numbed through the thick soles of my boots. "We're going to spend every weekend marching," we said to ourselves back then. Though we didn't, of course. When I scroll through photos of that time and the months that followed, I see ordinary life too. Images of Raphael dressed in an academic gown and grey V-necked pullover, improvised Hogwarts, for a literary-themed costume party at school. It was that kind of school. Or grinning goofily with a friend on the waterfront at Brooklyn Bridge Park at dusk, the Manhattan skyline framed behind them and the wide East River glistening. There are images of Raphael with his arms gleefully thrown around his big brothers, George's three older sons, all grown men now, though when I first knew them, they were still a distance from adolescence, the oldest barely 13, the younger ones 11 and 8. There's Raphael's 12th birthday party, held in a playground near our house, with water pistols and cupcakes and a gaggle of kids, wet-haired from the sprinklers and glowing in the early summer heat. There's an annual camping trip with friends to Fire Island, where the kids frolicked in the cold surf of the Atlantic by day and played after sunset on the shore, wheeling through the darkness with coloured lights attached to their fingers. We adults drank red wine from plastic mugs and talked about the books that we'd been reading under our
Sample complete. Ready to continue?